Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people I have had the pleasure of meeting and interacting with who bring more intelligence to bear more regularly, for sure, than does our first guest. He is Daniel Horowitz, senior editor at Conservative Review. He is a former contributor to virtually every other major publication that matters in the conservative movement. Check out his show, Conservative Conscience, and also his book, tremendously well done and timely analysis entitled Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back. It is so good to have you. How are you?
Great to be with you from one stranger in his country to another.
A stranger in a strange land, as they say. Becoming stranger by the day. And I did want to ask you specifically, keying off of your important book, Stolen Sovereignty, about this Judge Sabra, Dana Sabra, a judge who has, as you put it, ended national borders with a recent ruling, which is now the want of these federal judges, very expansive in its character. Talk us through that, if you would, Daniel, please.
Well, all your listeners should know who Sabra is. He's the new president, the new commander-in-chief. Basically, this is a problem we've talked about on air for many years, that the ACLU or other left-wing pro-open borders litigation groups could shop around to any district judge, grant rights to illegal aliens that have never been given for 200 years, violate our sovereignty, and get that district judge to put a nationwide injunction on our border policies, and that's it. So this is a judge who said, we must marshal all our resources from ICE and DHS to reunite these children with their parents when, as you well know, a lot of them were separated for good reason, for the same reason why American children are often separated from dangerous parents, or certainly parents who aren't even their parents. In this case, many of them, they had to ensure they weren't reunited or united initially with drug smugglers and human smugglers. And indeed, according to DHS and HHS, 20% of the parents were unfit to regain custody because they thought they either weren't their parents, they were very dangerous. And the judge said, I don't care. You must do it. You cannot run DNA tests. You cannot wait to get proper documentations. Whatever motion the ACLU filed for, they did. Finally, it culminated this week when the judge said that the ACLU is right and I'm going to grant them a motion to stay their deportations for an entire week, which will probably be extended. So here's the point that your listeners need to understand. On the one hand, the judge was saying you can't separate them and treat them on a dual track. Treat them differently from their criminal parents, you have to reunite them. All right, fine. We reunite them at a very bitter cost. Now let's deport them. Oh, no. Now they have a dual track because the kids, they might want to stay in the country. So they need time to consult their parents.
And Daniel Horowitz, what I think keeps cropping up, you alluded to it there, is this group, the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, am I right in my recollection that this was founded by radical leftists, if not communists, with a very anti-American agenda, which certainly seems to be now playing out through this lawfare that they're exercising, unfortunately, with great success against our interests and security?
Exactly. They are more powerful than Republican control of legislatures, of Congress, or anything, because we are told erroneously that the judiciary is supreme. We're now told that even a district judge, not just the Supreme Court, could be supreme and told unless he's overturned, which often it takes years for that to happen. And the ACLU, essentially controls the arc of litigation and could shop us around to wherever they want to go. So they take every issue that's national in scope to a California judge, which is essentially like having Antifa on the bench, and have that regarded as the final say over national security and sovereignty issues.
Let me quickly turn to one other piece of the very broad canvas that you're painting at the moment, Daniel, at Conservative Review, namely this whole issue of foreign interference. Actually, properly understood, pales into insignificance compared to what is now being done by judges and bureaucrats to enable foreigners to actually determine our policies by voting. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
It's unbelievable. And if we actually had an attentive and focused Republican Party conservative movement, we'd be making this play call right now. Now that the Democrats have blown up this issue of foreign interference to the magnitude of pretty much the most important issue of the election, we should jujitsu that for the real foreign intervention. And that's this. Look, the Russian attempts to, you know, influence our election, hack into DNC servers, that's an important problem, but that's a security counterintelligence issue. It's not an electoral issue. At the end of the day, it's the people in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin who voted that determined the outcome of the election and elected Donald Trump. But what about foreign nationals actually casting ballot in our election? If you're concerned about this Russian interference, you should be concerned by this issue by a factor of 10,000.
Yeah, it's not just influencing the vote, it's actually casting the vote.
Casting the votes, and not only don't they care, they downright support it. Here's the equation of devastation. We have on the front end motor voter law, where there's a seamless transition from obtaining a driver's license to being registered to vote. Then we have the courts mandating, there's the courts again in some states, or states doing it willingly in about a dozen states, granting illegal aliens driver's license. Then we have no back end check or mandated check to verify proof of citizenship. And in fact, the states that want to verify proof of citizenship, once again, the courts say they can't do it. So think about it. You put that all together. Oh, and by the way, some states are now starting this phenomenon of automatic voter registration, where they just take lists of motor voter or from the motor vehicle associations of each state, those that have driver's licenses, automatically register them to vote. And now you downright have localities like San Francisco and Boston registering non-citizens, legal and illegal immigrants to vote in local elections. Good luck trying to wall that off for federal elections, where obviously they can vote.
Right, where they're not supposed to vote, at the very least.
Yeah, putting this all together, it doesn't take a genius to recognize how you could have a certain percentage of them downright voting in our election. And our buddies over at Public Interest Legal Foundation, headed by our friend J. Christian Adams, they have done yeoman's work on this. And particularly in Pennsylvania, they estimate over 100,000 non-citizens are registered to vote. Remember, that's a very critical battleground state. And they have found several hundred that have cast ballots. Now, that might not sound like a big number. Here's the deal. We don't know how many cast ballots. Those are the ones that self-reported, because this is such an existential threat that you don't even have to insidiously be trying to illegally vote.
Daniel Horowitz is always a brilliant analysis of this. People can find it at conservativereview.org. Check out all of Daniel Horowitz's writings, The Conservative Conscience Indeed. Thank you for being with us, and come back to us again very soon, if you would, Daniel. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Stephen Blank about the summit with Russia, where we go from here, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined by one of the country's leading authorities on matters involving Russia. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank. He served for over two decades as a professor of national security affairs at the Army War College. He has been extraordinarily productive in terms of his writing some 1,000 articles, and he's published or edited 15 books. He is really one of the go-to guys on matters involving U.S.-Russian relations and more broadly what the Russians are up to. He is these days a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council and always a welcome guest here. Dr. Blank, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Well, I know that you have been in a full employment program, I'm sure, at least since the summit between Vladimir Putin and President Trump last week. Give us, you know, sort of your macro picture view of what happened there and where we find ourselves in its aftermath.
In a word, I think that the summit was a fiasco, and that's becoming ever more obvious. It's not just a question of Trump's awful performance at his press conference, and which he has continued to do since he's come back. It's also that it's appearing now that there are things at this summit that were very disturbing that are about to come out. The other day, right after the summit, the Russian Ministry of Defense and now the government come out and said that there were agreements reached between the Russian and the U.S. military and that the Russian military is moving to implement them. And the U.S. military, as reported this morning, has no idea what anybody's talking about, which means that somebody is lying or that somebody went into this conference very badly prepared and doesn't even understand what his side agreed to. I leave it to the listeners to decide who that is. The second point about this is the comments the president makes about NATO. It's unfortunate and sad to have to say this, but it's very clear that Mr. Trump has no idea what NATO is all about and why it's essential to international, not just American, but international security. And as a result of this, he is continuing to weaken America. Rather than making America great, he's making it weak. And this is a harsh thing to say, but it's true.
Can you just explore with me, we'll come back to NATO in a moment, Stephen Blank, but there are pieces of this agenda that Vladimir Putin laid out in the course of his opening remarks at the press conference. We'll talk a little bit more about all of this with David Goldman in a moment, but I'm interested in your take on it. My view of it was dating as I do back to the Cold War, that a lot of it seemed to be just sort of warmed over items, active measures, if you will, that the Soviets had been promoting back in the Cold War and seemingly have, you know, continued to be priorities for the Putin regime. Are those some of the things that you are concerned about as well, whether they're the arms control pieces or, you know, keeping weapons out of space or whether they're, you know, constraining our missile defenses or, you know, having academics tell us how to run our relations with Russia? I mean, these are all sort of hardy perennials, aren't they, of Kremlin past, as I say, active measures?
Yes, it's remarkable just how much similarity there is in Putin's agenda to old Soviet issues and agendas also. I mean, part of this is geography, but a part of it is also that, after all, Putin and his team are veterans of the KGB, and they've never really grown out of that mentality. So as long as there are nuclear weapons, arms control is going to be an agenda. I think, I mean, that just has to be understood. And the other aspects are that Russia regards the advancement of democracy in Europe as a threat to its vital interests, because that makes it much more difficult for Putin's kleptocratic regime to stay in power. That's the primary reason why they invaded Ukraine, is to prevent Ukraine from providing an example of what democratic rule would mean, because that would put his regime under enormous pressure. So there is a very strong continuity in many ways, not just foreign policy, between today's Moscow and, let's say, the Moscow of Brezhnev. And indeed, Putin's press secretary several years ago said that for us, Leonid Brezhnev is not a minus, which is an amazing statement when you think about it, but that's the way things are.
I take the point that, you know, arms control is kind of, a hardy perennial of the nuclear weapons dynamic, Steve Blank, but what I'm getting at is that, as you suggested, is the case with respect to some unspecified actions that the Russian military has taken, that were the president in these closed sessions to have indicated an agreement of some kind, even at a pretty abstract level, to the old Soviet agendas with respect to arms control, papering over the fact that the Soviets and now the Russians have violated every agreement that we've signed with them, and ignoring the fact that the Russians have now essentially completed the modernization of their nuclear arsenal, and we've scarcely begun to modernize ours. This would be almost certainly a very problematic moment in this whole, as I say, arms control dynamic, would it not?
Well, yes, that's what the reason Putin wants to talk about an arms control treaty, because he's just finished building, as you said, and we have scarcely begun. So he thinks he has an advantage, and of course that advantage dissipates over time as we catch up. As you know, that historically been one of the motives whenever the Soviets called for arms controls when they had just finished building, because they couldn't afford to go on to the next stage right away.
Or at least to the extent that it does lock us into an inferior position, then it's of interest always, yeah. I think, to them.
And if not inferior, at least suboptimal. But even more importantly, I mean, there's all the regional issues are not different. I mean, the fact is that the government in Moscow has never really accepted the territorial consequences of the end of the Cold War. Second, as Putin's government has said since 2005, by the way, not just yesterday, they're at war with the West. And this is not a shooting war, but it's information warfare, subversion, all the things that we saw in the intervention in not only in our election, but all over the European continent, perhaps in Mexico, other places as well.
This is a point that is often overlooked. So it's one of the reasons we value so much our conversations with you, Dr. Stephen Blank. Let me ask you about something else that you've just made as a contribution to our understanding, our situational awareness, as the military would say, that is in need of a lot more attention. And that is the naval buildup of the Russians for the purpose of, as you've put it, creating a mare clausus, a closed sea, in what have heretofore been international waters of the Black Sea. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Steve, and what it portends for perhaps the Eastern Mediterranean and beyond in the future.
In Russian history, the Russians have always regarded the Black Sea as their sea, as a closed sea. And whenever Moscow has been strong with regard to the domination of the Black Sea, invariably, since the time of Catherine the Great, 240 years ago, they have then moved to project military power into the Middle East and the Mediterranean. And they're doing it again now. They did this from the 60s to the 80s. Those of us who are old enough to remember this know this very well. And Stalin tried to do it in the 40s as well, and throughout Tsarist history as well. So this is what we're seeing now. And they are thereby threatening all the littoral states of the Black Sea, as well as Western interests in the Middle East and the Mediterranean. They are attempting to build a network of military bases, not only in the Middle East, but also in the Black Sea, in the Balkans. They are a threat now to allies of the United States, like Romania. For example, Romania now has a maritime border with Russia because of the Russian occupation of Ukraine. And Romania is very concerned about its energy futures because they're developing energy offshore. Those are vulnerable to Russian threats.
And the Russians have, as I understand it, actually stolen some of their oil platforms and are beginning to tap into some of those Romanian resources. Is that correct, in the Black Sea?
I'm not at liberty to tell you the whole story, but the Russians have made overt threats to Romanian energy. Let me put it that way. And this is obviously a hostile act. Some might even construe it as a sign of impending aggression. This underscores why NATO is essential.
Yep. Let me ask you quickly about one other thing, Stephen Blank. There is a woman by the name of Maria Butina who has been arrested here in the United States and charged with acting as an agent of influence or spy or something by our government on behalf of the Russians. She's being held now without bail as a flight risk. There is a prosecution looming, of course. I'm struck, Steve, by the contrast between how her case is being handled and what was done with respect to a ring of clandestine operatives who were under deep cover working for the Soviet intelligence services, who had penetrated, we're told, the Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer political machines back in, for some 10 years they were running this operation. I think they were rolled up in 2010. Every single one of them was released in short order and sent back to Russia, where they received a hero's welcome. Am I missing something, or is there a very stark contrast between the two? And if so, why do you think?
Well, there is a contrast, but Ms. Butina was not arrested under the espionage laws. These other 10 people were, which means to me that she was not caught spying, and therefore we can't charge her with espionage.
Well, but it would make it seem all the more bizarre that she, having violated apparently the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which is violated every day, as you know, in this town, and that she's being held in a rather draconian way versus how spies were treated.
Well, as you know, we got people back in return for the 10 who were sent back to Russia. Not many, but intelligence organizations are deeply concerned that if their people get caught and they knowingly run that risk, that their government will get them back. So it's a point of honor and credibility to an intelligence agency that you actually recover your people because they've willingly assumed the risk. And you know, they have to know that you're going to try to get them back home.
Yeah. I have to say, Steve, this seems to me to be pretty small potatoes, but you may be right. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, and I hope we'll be able to get you back to talk more about it in the near future. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman. We'll get his take on Russia, China, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as we often have the pleasure of being, approximately every week, as a matter of fact, by David Goldman, an extraordinary intellect and analyst when it comes especially to matters involving economics and national security. He writes under the byline Spengler at Asia Times. He is the author of How Civilizations Die, and he is one smart cookie, and we're always delighted to be able to pick his brains a little bit about particularly matters that involve Asia. And I do want to talk with you about China in a moment, David, but I can't resist the temptation to sort of do a little stock taking with you, if I could use that expression, with a financier like you, about Russia, the thrashing that is going on at the moment in the aftermath of the president's summit with Vladimir Putin is something to behold. I'm interested in sort of your take on it at the macro level, and then we'll get down into some of the particulars.
The U.S. intelligence community blew up a very minor Russian operation, maybe $10 million with a bunch of spooks playing with false Facebook accounts, and turned it into a question mark over the outcome of the 2016 election. These are people who don't like Trump and want to question his legitimacy. The president is understandably furious about this. He took the opportunity of his press conference with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki to talk about why the intelligence community shouldn't be doing this. That was clearly the wrong moment to do it. We shouldn't be airing our own dirty laundry in front of prospective adversaries like Putin. But who cares? The facts are that Trump was elected in a free and fair election. The Russian meddling, to the extent it was there in the election, was a marginal, trivial matter of no great import. Major powers play games with each other's elections all the time. Obama tried to rig the election against Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, and none of the same people complained about this.
With taxpayer dollars, no less, as I recall.
All right. We see in the polls that Republican voters are massively supporting the president, as well they should. He doesn't filter himself. He has poor impulse control. He probably should have picked another opportunity to talk about it. But the idea that he somehow betrayed American national security interests is just ridiculous, and his base isn't buying it, neither do I.
Good. Let me ask you about some of the particulars, David. Most especially, there was an agenda that was alleged by Vladimir Putin in his opening remarks at the press conference with Donald Trump after their summit to have been agreed. And the president is sort of referring to this agenda, seemingly, when he says there are big things coming and he's got his team working on it. The Russians are putting out the word that the Russian ambassador is going to be coming back to Washington shortly and will be going to every office in Washington to advance the agenda. Among the things that are part of that agenda, and the whole thing, frankly, struck me as just a warmed over version of what the Kremlin has been trying to do going back to Soviet days, the height of the Cold War, for that matter. I'm thinking particularly, and wanted to get your take on it, of this idea that we're going to somehow contract out, maybe a slight exaggeration, but I think that's the Putin agenda at least, to a group of academics, political scientists, business leaders, former politicians, policymakers, who knows, the whole, you know, sort of conduct or proper nature of the U.S.-Russian relationship. Does that trouble you at all, knowing what you do about, well, you know, business interests trumping, for example, national security concerns?
Well, no one's going to make that much money in Russia because it's an economy the size of Italy. I think Putin likes to exaggerate his own importance. The only place where he has important cards to play right now is in Syria, where he saved the Assad regime and sponsored the incursion of the Iranians. So since he brought the Iranians in, he can use that as a negotiating tool with the United States and Israel to try to limit them. You bring in a vicious dog and you say, for the right price, I'll put him on a leash. Putin's ability to make Iran a major threat to the United States is clearly limited by the president's very wise and apparently successful pressure on Iran, whose economy is imploding. The Russians know perfectly well Iran is not an effective and strong long-term ally. It's a very problematic ally for them, so they're looking to trade it away for something else. I don't think Putin has a grand agenda because there isn't anything he can deliver to anybody, particularly in the economic sphere at this point. So Putin's an annoying spoiler, but I think that problem is essentially manageable. Whether we manage it optimally is a different issue.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that he, and I thought you were going to enumerate this, has presumably to use as leverage, David Goldman, is his nuclear capabilities, which he has pursued and modernized very aggressively, and combined with a doctrine that seems to be very aggressive as well, in fact, downright threatening to our allies and to us. Do you expect that will be a feature of this relationship that the presidents seemingly want to cultivate, either arms control past or warmed over or future, or some other diminishing of the threat that seems to me is quite real and growing?
It's not at all clear to me what Putin can extract from us in terms of nuclear weapons. I think Trump would be well advised to pursue aggressively missile defense, including space-based missile defense. Putin wouldn't like that. Most immediately, what I would advise the administration to do is to throw whatever resources we need to do to make obsolete all of Russia's air defense systems, the S-400 and the coming S-500. Those are very good systems, and they may be the best in the world, but the technology exists in principle on the drawing board to neutralize them, and we should make that a priority. That would clip Putin's wings and eliminate a great deal of Russia's power to intimidate people.
Amen. It does seem, though, that is part of the agenda that he is trying to advance. For example, limiting our missile defenses, limiting our space-based capabilities, among other things. I suspect countermeasures to his air defenses as well. Let me turn to China. David, you have suggested in a recent piece, I believe at Asia Times, directed in the form of an open letter to Larry Kudlow, the president's economic advisor, that it's time for a different strategy, by which I take it you mean let's get off this tariff business and focus on other ways of countering China's threat. As it happens, as we're speaking, there is a hearing getting ready to get underway in the House Intelligence Committee that will be focusing very directly on the so-called unrestricted warfare, unquote, that the Chinese have been engaged in against us, particularly in the economic sphere, for quite some time. Your thoughts about all of that and specifically what the new strategy ought to entail?
Look, Larry Kudlow has been a friend of mine for 30 years. We worked together at Bear Stearns. He's a wonderful guy. Tariffs are not the right way to deal with China. Most of what China ships to the United States are consumer goods. Only about a third of the value of those goods is Chinese content. They import components from the United States, from Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan, assemble them cheaply in China, and send the smartphone or whatever to the United States. So with a few exceptions, like some telecom equipment, which we shouldn't be buying from them, we should not put a tariff on it. We should just ban it because it's a national security issue. Apart from that, tariffs will just hurt the U.S. consumer, and the Chinese have been trying to ship those cheap assembly industries to lower-cost labor countries like Pakistan and Vietnam and Indonesia for years. So that's just throwing Brer Xi into the briar patch. What we need is to target critical new technologies that the Chinese are trying to advance beyond us with and make sure that we absolutely dominate them. Quantum computing, space-based missile defense, artificial intelligence, and a dozen other things. Larry talked about the Chinese trying to steal our crown jewels. China plays dirty. They've been stealing technology for a long time. I think we should take really tough measures to keep any Chinese company out of anywhere near the supply chain that goes into military goods. 100% domestic content for high-tech military goods. It'll cost more, but it's worth it. We should stop them from buying our tech companies. That's absolutely right. But that's the old crown jewels. We need to focus on developing the new crown jewels. That's how we won the Cold War. It was Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. It was Harold Brown's DARPA during the 1970s. It was JFK's moonshot, the Sputnik response by the Eisenhower administration. And the scary thing is that the number of engineers in the U.S. peaked in 1969 when we went to the moon. We are increasingly dependent, particularly in anything to do with hardware or physics, on foreign countries. We're not putting the money into it. Our kids aren't going into those fields. 80% of the doctoral students in STEM fields in most universities are foreign, and the largest number is Chinese. That's an intolerable situation. And I'm worried about the Chinese inventing the next generation of crown jewels. That's where we have to focus. All the tariffs are going to do is get the Europeans and others to line up against us and make deals with the Chinese behind our backs. They're already doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be interested to see how Larry Kudlow and also Peter Navarro respond to this suggestion. We'll be following it closely with your good help in the days ahead. David Goldman, thank you for the work you do at Asia Times. It's always a delight to talk with you, and I'll look forward to doing so next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Reggie Littlejohn. We'll take stock with her of the social contract in China versus social control. That and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Reggie Littlejohn is in the house, at least virtually. We're always pleased to have her with us. She is the president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers, a splendid organization doing really important work on behalf of women whose voices are generally not allowed to be heard, notably in places like China and India and elsewhere, especially as it relates to some of the most intrusive and demeaning and horrific behavior of governments with respect to the women's rights to reproduce. And this is a very important topic that I'm looking forward to visiting and getting an update about with Reggie. But first of all, let me say welcome back. It's so good to have you. And I wanted just to visit with you a little bit sort of at the 30,000 foot level on how China, the subject of a hearing in the House Intelligence Committee today, is how it's really violating kind of the social contract with its own people through this kind of what was once a one-child policy, now a two-child policy, but broaden the lens for us a little bit about how you see that the relationship between China and its people and what it says about the character of the regime.
Well, I mean, there is really no acknowledgement of a social contract by the Chinese government to the Chinese people. Something that people forget, that we say Chinese government and people think it's the Chinese equivalent of the American government. It's not. They took over by violence. The Chinese Communist Party did. They were never elected. And they have been extremely, I would say, rapacious of the human rights of their people. In the United States, we have what we call inalienable rights. And that is something that we believe derives from God, that we are human beings created in the image of God, and we have rights given by God that cannot be violated by the government. The Chinese government is officially atheistic. And they believe that they are the source of rights, and they are the ones who get to give or deny rights. And so they're a brutal totalitarian regime, and that comes out in many ways, including in their coercive population control policies and in the persecution of religions, including Christians.
And to the extent that this is translated, you've discussed this with me in the past, Reggie, but I think especially as we're trying to get our heads around some of these differences, and I think that's a very important point. There is no social contract, in fact. In fact, the Chinese Communist Party regards the people as there to serve them very, very directly. And to the extent that this involves this incredibly intrusive social control of even women's reproductive activities and conduct, it's kind of a paradigm, isn't it, for the larger character of the relationship between the governed and the governing?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the course of population control is just emblematic of the kind of control they have in virtually every aspect of life. And that would include religion, and that would include anything. There were a few years ago, there were some women who organized to oppose sexual harassment on public transportation, which no one opposes. I mean, who's in favor of sexual harassment on public transportation? And yet they were arrested, and no one could figure out why. The only thing I can say is, even though the Chinese government would oppose sexual harassment on public transportation, they will arrest anyone who is organizing people for any reason, even a reason that they agree with, because they want total control of everything.
Yeah. And one of the things that is now emerging, Reggie Littlejohn, in the furtherance of that sort of total control is something that's being called the social credit score. And it's not entirely clear what all goes into evaluating your social credit score in China, but it seems as though it's basically everything. It's all of your biometric details and your online conduct and commercial transactions and essentially every aspect of your life that now can be subjected to big data collection and mining, I guess. How would the sorts of things that you have been concerned about, Reggie, fare as this kind of totalitarian, I mean, it kind of is Orwell 1984 on steroids, isn't it? How would this make matters just infinitely worse for the people of China?
Well, the social credit score system is just, like you said, it's completely Orwellian. And they will gather things up from all the sources that you mentioned, including online conduct. If you tweet something that is against the government, it will seriously damage your social credit score. And what they do with these social credit scores is if you have a bad social credit score, meaning that you have taken any kind of issue with the Chinese government, which would include, for example, if you violated the population control policy or if you were a Christian in an unregistered church, that would impact your score. And then what happens with people with poor social credit scores is they cannot get loans. They can be impeded in travel. They can lose their jobs. And then you put that together with the surveillance cameras and the facial recognition that they that the Chinese government has installed, for example, at train stations. And they even required them to be installed in certain churches in one province in China. That during holidays that they can find people who have poor social credit scores potentially and detain them. So again, it's horrific.
As you're talking, the thought occurred to me that even if you're not detained, this imposes a sort of virtual gulag, doesn't it? I mean, it impacts all aspects of your life. It punishes you. It constrains you from earning a living and the like. It's a powerful instrument for ensuring that people are coerced into conforming. Hey, you mentioned, speaking of conforming, Reggie, several times now, the persecution of Christians. As you know, there is a campaign, I'm very delighted to say, a part of it, as am I, on behalf of saving persecuted Christians. Talk a little bit about the fate of the church at the moment in China. There's a church and then there's a church. There's the official church, the government-blessed and run church, and then there's the so-called underground churches. What is the character of this dynamic at the moment as you see it? Obviously, this is a threat to the Chinese government, hence this idea that only the official churches can survive. But what's the state of play with respect to persecution on the ground in China for Christians?
Persecution has greatly increased in China, even beginning in February of this year, when the Chinese government promulgated new regulations and that everybody has to be registered and that all churches need to conform to these regulations. Now, the regulations state that, and the reason is they want everybody to register is that they want to control the exercise of religion such that the registered churches you're only allowed to worship at certain times, in certain places. You can't evangelize. You cannot, there's places in China where you can't even evangelize to your own children. They restrict any kind of literature that you send out. And the Chinese government over the last couple of years has really gone out to lower the visibility of Christianity to the extent that in one of the provinces they decapitated churches, that they just ripped the crosses off of thousands of churches. They've actually dynamited some churches. There was a pastor's wife who was buried alive defending her church. So this is the thing. Christian persecution in China is on the steep rise right now.
Yeah. Reggie Littlejohn, there is so much more to talk with you about on all of these counts. I just want to say again how much I personally admire the work you do and the courage with which you do it at Women's Rights Without Frontiers. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.